Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of May 14th, 2019. And we got your entire 2019 legislative recap of what passed in the Statehouse and, more importantly, what remains in a suspended state till the second year of session begins in January. We go beyond our Sine Die episode and look at other issues that passed. But dear leaders, we also update you on the big issues that didn't pass. Issues that we've covered over this year, such as dark money, civil asset forfeiture, education reform, plastic bag bans, medicinal marijuana, and more. The Lead is a podcast where we go behind the headlines with reporters who write the stories affecting you. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. You can listen to all four sections instead of wondering why the royal baby's name is Archie and not Archibald. Kind of gauche. Or wondering what HBO is going to do now that Veep is over and Game of Thrones is about to be. I don't think Barry has what it takes. That's just me. And now for our brief quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present, but here in the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. Number one, the Associated Press reports that prosecutors and defense attorneys will soon pick a jury in the death penalty trial of Timothy Jones Jr., who was charged with killing his five children in their South Carolina home in 2014. It took more than 2 weeks to narrow a pool of about 150 people down to the 50-member pool that lawyers and Judge Eugene Griffith say can fairly decide the case. The judge believes that testimony in the Jones murder trial can begin this week. Now, this will be a big case to watch, guys. Number two, the Greenville News reports that officials found that Veterans Victory House, a nursing home for veterans in Walterboro, has repeatedly failed to properly investigate injuries and claims of abuse, and they have used misleading language in their records to make serious incidents appear minor. This according to inspectors who are looking into more than a dozen complaints. Now, inspectors spent at least 5 days investigating these complaints and documenting faults in December, according to records from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that were recently obtained by the Greenville News and the Independent Mail. Things were so bad at the home in Walterboro that inspectors found the existence of, quote, immediate jeopardy, which is a rare designation of danger that can result in residents being moved into another facility right away. Number three, the state newspaper reports that Richard Quinn, the legendary South Carolina political consultant, will be arraigned on perjury charges Tuesday morning, according to Jim Parks, clerk of the state grand jury. Quinn was indicted last month by a state grand jury on 11 counts of perjury and one count of obstruction of justice, charges connected mostly to an alleged network of illegal influence peddling in the state legislature. And number four, the Associated Press reports that Shonda Jefferson, who teaches in Fairfield County, was named the South Carolina Teacher of the Year. She's in her eighth year teaching high school biology. Jefferson won the $25,000 prize, the chance to drive a BMW for a year, and a chance to spend the next year working at a center to recruit and retain the best teachers. Jefferson said that she thinks there's a movement growing to change education in South Carolina. And for our news segment, the Florida Man News, which each week we give you just a little headline taste of the most captivating Florida Man news, we kind of decided to flip the script a little bit and give you some Florida Woman news. That's right. This week, Florida woman pulls alligator from her pants during traffic stop. And just like Kawhi Leonard, a doink, 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 buried the Sixers, we buried the Lead.
Gavin, why are you doing this to me?
Yeah, it's just sports.
This is not fair.
Lead Sports Minute.
Not fair!
Anyone but Philadelphia. Well, that's the ballgame, folks. The first year of the 123rd legislative session just ended. But fear not, bills that didn't pass remain in a state of in-session suspension. That's because lawmakers will pick up where they left off when they return for the second and final year of session, which begins in January. Now, we dropped our Sine Die mini-pod last week, recapping the frenzy of the last day. In this episode, we'll break down the top legislative accomplishments, issues that didn't quite make it, and the occasional surprises that we have seen since January. Don't worry, this will be fun, I promise, even though it's going to be a little long. Joining me to discuss this is the Post and Courier's Shauna Adcox and the state newspaper's Avery Wilkes. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Special welcome to you, Avery. This is your first appearance on the show, and we also want to mention that you were recently named South Carolina's top business and government beat reporter of the year, as well as overall journalist of the year. So
yeah, congratulations. None of that compares to my first appearance on the lead
pod. Oh, well. Wow. Flattery gets you everywhere in this podcast. And a happy early birthday. Both of you had Sunday stories in your respective papers about the session, so let's take a look at what happened and what didn't. We've talked in previous episodes about the $9 billion budget, which had money in it for education, state employee pay raises, and more. And we'll get into that in another episode once that's finished and sent to the governor later this month. But outside the budget, it wasn't a big year for big issues. Some bills that we did see pass over the 18-week session would include the outlawing of child marriage, allow for audits of the state's 20 electric cooperatives, the solar bill that we previously talked about, a bill requiring rideshare drivers to post their license plate numbers on the front of their vehicles, retooling local government funding, and the creation of Veteran Affairs as a cabinet agency. So yeah, some not-so-riveting stuff there. Obviously important, but maybe not the most interesting. So now you know what passed. Let's look at what didn't pass. And for that, we want to give it a little bit of a Hunger Games vibe, if you will. You might remember the cannon shots when the tributes died. Ooh, yeah, there it is. Yeah. Now again, just because these bills get these cannon shots don't mean they're dead. They're just dead for session. They're in session suspension. They're all going to come back next year. Like Avengers Endgame, which I don't know, but I'm told I can use that reference accurately in this description. Avery, I want to start with you on this. Looking at home rule issue bills, and you had a story about this earlier on in the session, bills like that, the vaping bill and then also the plastic bag ban bill. Neither, of course, went anywhere, but kind of give us an idea about what those issues were about and maybe why they got stuck.
Sure. The story that we wrote a couple months ago was about how the South Carolina legislature, despite being, you know, dominated by Republicans who are all about states' rights and locals' ability to choose, have really taken on this idea that to be pro-business, we have to bar local governments from enacting their own legislation, whether it be to regulate vaping or to ban plastic bags or whatever. The legislature has in recent years, or even environmental protections for hog farms or against hog farms or chicken farms, whatever. The legislature has tended to err on the side of big business and against local government. And that's become problematic for areas like Charleston, Mount Pleasant, coastal areas that want to ban plastic bags. And the state's telling them you can't, or that potentially your ban is now not effective. And they're doing that on behest of the plastic industry or whatever industry is lobbying them. The argument for it is that you don't want to have a state where you have these patchwork quilt regulations where one town can't sell vaping products, but a town 10 miles away can. And so you have people going back and forth and sort of being generally confused about what is legal and what is not. And then the argument against those kind of bills.
Because we don't have that problem with alcohol, right?
Or fireworks, yeah, or whatever else. And the argument against that is obviously that if I'm, you know, Joe Smith and I live in Mount Pleasant and I do or don't want plastic bags, I can go to my city council and it's a 5-minute drive and I can tell my city council what I feel, and cities and counties can make those decisions for themselves. But now I have to go to the state house, which is tougher. They work on weekdays during the day, and it's not really the most efficient place of government as well.
I will add, on the plastic bags, it's a little different because you've got – it's geographic as well as it's not pro-business, anti-business kind of thing. It's Republicans versus Republicans, coastal Republicans versus inland Republicans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's same with offshore drilling as well. Yeah. So that's an issue that has been playing out. And so far, those bills have not passed. I think there was a move late in the Senate to bring it up, and that was defeated by a very close vote. So those are certainly issues that we're going to be grappling with next year.
Mm-hmm. We'll send those two bills up to the rafters right now. Shauna, dark money, limited movement on this. We did see that pretty big eye-popping report from your coworker, Andy Brown, about just how many millions of dollars flow into the state elections that he could figure out and we could find.
Yeah, who knows how much.
Exactly. We don't really know the extent of the other ones. We did see some limited movement on two bills towards the end of the session there. Do you think, you know, looking at just how the track record goes with ethics reforms in the state house, that this is... Do you think that's kind of par for the course, where it's, hey, we're trying to do something, but it's also the end of the session and we'll see what happens next year?
I think there is going to be a push from outside groups that are pushing for more transparency. you know, you've got the Koch brothers on one side that definitely wants to quash these bills. And then you've got this other group that really is fighting for transparency. And they're going to be fighting in South Carolina and some other states, primarily South Carolina, because it's an early primary state. So it might be interesting to see how that plays out.
One problem with trying to pass these bills, and this is something that lawmakers have told me, even during the State House corruption probe, is that I don't get calls about ethics.
Right.
I don't get calls from my constituents, from Republican primary voters, from Democratic primary voters about ethics. And if I do, it's the one guy or it's John Krangel calling me, you know. It's not a kitchen table issue that I think people universally say we want good government, not corrupt government. Mm-hmm. But they don't say, you know, these dark money groups are influencing legislation and they're, you know, they're trying to defeat the gas tax hike or whatever. You know, they care about schools, education, they care about, you know, whatever. But it's not really ethics or some of these more nuanced ethics provisions.
Which is even still even more surprising to see such reaction, especially in light of the State House corruption probe that ensnared so many lawmakers. But it's neither here nor there right now. So we'll send dark money to its dark death. But we'll see it next year, I'm sure, maybe. Who knows? Avery, civil asset forfeiture. I know this was a big Greenville news story. But just kind of looking back at how this kind of played out during the session, we saw the Greenville News do their take-in series talking about how pervasive and complex this unconstitutional practice is for law enforcement that, you know, seizes people's cash or property on very, you know, very limited reasoning, if any at all. And sometimes these people aren't even charged. And we saw a huge response from lawmakers, bipartisan response in the lobby saying, hey, we're going to push forward. We're going to revamp. We're going to overhaul civil asset forfeiture. And then there's also another bill looking at, you know, tracking this, making a database for this. And neither of those really came to fruition. They kind of fizzled out there.
The issues that the Greenville News highlighted were just huge. And I think, you know, that story got nationwide interest. I think there was a bill filed in Congress in response to it. And it was a multi-part series that exposed a lot of problems that have been ongoing. And that kind of thing is really difficult to solve in 1 year and without watering down the bill to an extent that it doesn't do that much. And so it got a lot of momentum, and then you start to hear questions about it. How is this going to affect XYZ law enforcement agency? And some of those questions, once they started to bubble up, really slowed the bill down. I don't think that bill necessarily deserves the Hunger Game cannon shot for now, for sure. But you know, I think it could it could pass next year as soon as some of those questions and some of those outstanding issues start to be answered. I think lawmakers have gotten since the nuclear debacle, they are much more hesitant about just passing a bill just because another lawmaker tells them it's a good bill or just because a lobbyist tells them it's a good bill. They're, especially with big things like this, there seems to be a lot of hesitancy toward what are the negative ramifications of this? What's going to happen in 10 years when we find out this is a terrible bill and my name has been on it? And so that may be one of the issues with this one.
Yeah, and there's that study committee looking at it as well at this point, but we're still going to have to give it a cannon shot. just because you get it doesn't mean it's not going to come back next year.
The study committee and the cannon shot go hand in hand.
Yeah, I think every study committee should have a cannon shot.
Study committee is the tactic you use when you don't want to deal with something.
Study committee, task force, it's all bad news for the bill.
Well, we're going to have a commission formed at some point. Education reform, I don't think we even need to go into this that much because we've been talking about it on every episode. There's money in the budget for it, but Shauna, this is a debate we're going to see going forward next year, of course, with not only reform and overall.
Well, and next year they'll hopefully get on to the whole funding method. You know, the report was released last Thursday that sets a new model, at least on how to fund schools. It doesn't really make any recommendations, but you know, they're going to be collecting information over the summer from people who. Their ideas on what class sizes should be, yada, yada. So I invite everybody out there to actually look at my article. And I do have a link in the article to the report.
Is something going to happen next year? And if not, what does that mean? Are we going to say, I mean, we did see the 10,000 teachers march. I'm guessing they'll probably ramp up before session starts again.
Yeah, frankly, if they're going to have any real impact, it needs to be not at the very end of the session when it's impossible for them to have an impact. So I've heard they might do something in December or early January. We'll see. I certainly hope that they again make education their top priority and actually get something done.
So yeah, cannon shot there for education reform. Medicinal marijuana, Shauna again, is 366. Tom Davis's bill, that's been a, you know, always been coming up, but it's always been facing similar opposition.
Yeah, poor Tom Davis. He's so hopeful every year.
Mm-hmm.
And
we saw a lot of back and forth with, you know, advocates for it, and you know, coming
right
after we saw
well,
a big
and that mailer
anti
completely backfired.
Mm-hmm. The big old pot party,
right? Yeah, it actually stemmed a lot of support for the legislation, but that legislation just is not going to move until Mark Keel and the Sheriff's Association gets behind it in some form, and that's not going to happen ever until the federal government declares marijuana legal in some fashion. Mm-hmm.
That and the Attorney General's press conference in which he mistakenly declared it the most dangerous drug in America and then claimed that he didn't say
right
that even though he was on
because
video saying it.
Leads to other ones. Yeah, definitely. If you want to double check all that, listen to our Medicinally Adequate episode. We talked about that in depth. So that's something that we're going to maybe, I don't even know what, it might get out of committee next year. I mean, it's gone out of committee before, but it's still, like he says, one of the strictest bills in the country when it comes to medicinal marijuana. But
I don't think you're ever going to convince Mark Keel that you're going to make it strict enough so that it won't lead to people doing it recreationally.
Mm-hmm. Cannon shot.
Yeah.
Avery, kind of wrapping up here, also the DUI interlock bill, do you remember covering this a little bit during the session?
Yeah.
Just kind of making it stricter for people who get DUIs that they have to install an interlock device in their car. And that passed the Senate really quickly earlier on in the session, which is always surprising to see. But we didn't see any movement really in House Judiciary.
Which is surprising. That's usually a bill you think would pass the House first and then die in the Senate when folks like Brad Hutto, Gerald Malloy get their hands on it and start to point out some of the problems with the bill. Those are actually the guys who worked on this the most in the Senate. And it's, like you said, hasn't gotten a subcommittee hearing in the House. I think it could. There's plenty of support behind it. The governor is a vocal supporter of it. There's the Mothers Against Drunk Driving group that held a rally on the statehouse grounds, I think in March or April. And so there's plenty of support, and there's going to be plenty of pressure. It's an election year. That's something that groups could focus on and say, hey, make sure your lawmaker is behind this kind of bill. But there are also some complications with that bill. You know, if you've got somebody who is charged with DUI and who eventually beats that charge in court, proves himself innocent or not guilty at least, but then they've been made to pay $1,000 or $750 or whatever the amount is for the ignition interlock, is that truly justice? You know, those are some questions that are going to have to be answered before this becomes law.
Just more calls that are associated with DUIs, but that's something that comes with drinking and driving. So we'll look into that. Mm-hmm. We'll see next year. So a cannon shot for the DUI interlock bill, S-18. And also just kind of want to touch on, there's a bill that we looked at, you know, using hospitality taxes for flood mitigation. Shauna, we don't know the ins and outs about this, but again, it zoomed through the Senate and has sat in the House Ways and Means since January. Do we think, looking at this bill, maybe looking at the interlock bill, is that, are those retaliatory efforts? I mean,
could be. Yeah.
I mean, the House also didn't move on the spadefish bill, right? I mean, that was kind of also a really weird bill. That
I have no idea about spadefish.
But I mean, in a way, you can say the same thing about S-1, which we saw get tacked on to all those bills dealing
right
with the governor's appointment power. So, is this kind of like what we were talking about when we talk about the tit for tat and the games that kind of get played up there?
Well, sure. The House will go, okay, well, you need to move on this for us to move on that, which frankly is all the House has in terms of their tactics.
Mm-hmm. And looking even within the chamber of the Senate itself, we did see in the last few days, we saw Senator Shane Martin use a procedural move to pull up a gun bill, a constitutional gun carry bill, S-139, and put it on the calendar. And Senator Marlon Kempson just really
blew up.
Yeah. I mean, because we didn't see any movement on any gun-related bills this session.
Right.
Then all of a sudden, with days left, it's all of a sudden on the calendar. It's bypassed subcommittee and committee to just being a point of leverage.
I can't imagine that bill is actually going to pass.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, talk about law enforcement being against something. They're really against that and have been for years. So it's gotten through the House before as it was tacked onto another bill, but it came over to the Senate and got defeated. So the idea of it having a chance in the Senate is certainly interesting and concerning to law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. And we saw that, you know, Senator Kempson did put his name against blocking that bill. So that's one of the things they can do in the Senate is block bills by just objecting to them. But it is in a position where if someone wanted to try and get something for something, have a debate on the gun bill, like the constitutional carry bill. But
yeah, there's going to be a lot of backroom negotiations on that one.
Mm-hmm. Avery, just kind of want to wrap up looking at Representative Josiah Magnuson and his dust up with Representative Nancy Mace in the House over her testimony, essentially, about her being raped when she was 16, and this came up during the fetal heartbeat abortion bill debate, too. Can you just elaborate on what happened and the politics that happened on the House floor?
Yeah, it's one of these pro-life versus pro-life dust-ups. I think you have to look at it chronologically. 2 weeks, or I guess now 3 weeks ago, Nancy Mace gets up during the fetal heartbeat abortion ban debate and argues for an exception for rape and incest. And she shares with everyone a story that she'd only revealed publicly in October 2018, that she was raped as a 16-year-old, that she was molested as a 14-year-old, and that she kept that basically to herself. And I think she told her mom and her best friend, but no one else. And she was explaining that people, you know, girls don't tell people when they've been sexually assaulted. And so, you know, they're not going to tell people in time to get an abortion before the 6-week abortion ban. Anyway, she gives out this really impassioned speech. I think it lasts 8 minutes. And they get the exception and the bill passes the House. It's another one that's probably not, you know, didn't pass this year, mm-hmm. may not pass the Senate next year. And then 2 weeks after that, on Tuesday, very pro-life Spartanburg Republican Josiah Magnuson passes out these cards that say it is a twisted logic that would kill the unborn child for the misdeed of the parent. And she goes on Facebook and explains that she kind of blasts it and says, you know, calling rape a misdeed is, you know, is wrong. It's an abhorrent crime. It's not just a misdeed. That's you shrugging it off. And calling the rapist a parent is also wrong. Rapists aren't parents. They're criminals. Then the next day, Josiah Magnuson, which I think is for some people what crossed the line, he passes out a letter responding to Mace's Facebook page on the House floor. And it kind of... he says it clarified the points they were making, but in some ways it was making those points stronger. And that was more of a direct target to Nancy Mace. Caused a huge dust up with the House Democrats and Nancy Mace, who see this as the pro-life movement responding to her story by sort of rubbing her face in it. That whole incident's going to come up when the House Republicans meet privately, probably later this month. Don't know if he's going to be in any hot water himself, but they will be reminded that, hey, you cannot do anything on the House floor that impugns the integrity or the character of one of your fellow members. So, mm-hmm. And that's that. There were a couple issues like that this past week. Jonathan Hill also said some things that could be construed as a personal attack towards Celeste Davis during the Santee Cooper debate. So it's sort of a chance for House Republicans to reset and kind of get back on terms where everyone is cordial to each other and making sure that maybe doing some sensitivity training so this kind of thing doesn't happen again.
Sean, I just want to really briefly talk about winners and losers you mentioned in your article. Who were some of the big winners and losers from this year's legislative session?
You know, it depends on how you look at it. Mm-hmm. You know, a winner can also be a loser because, I mean,
I have a participation award. I can't be a loser. I participated.
Well, it actually was tough for me to do because I couldn't do a straight winner headline and here are the things. It's like, oh, well, actually, that could be a loser depending on how you look at it. Mm-hmm. Like McMaster, he had a great year for the House.
Yeah.
And, you know, we finally had all three folks in terms of Speaker Lucas, Senate President Peeler, the governor's office, all on the same page on many instances. Mm-hmm. They even expanded the governor's cabinet, which normally they're very reticent to do. They don't want to expand the governor's powers. And lo and behold, this bill that's been floating out there for years, suddenly we have a new cabinet agency in terms of the Veterans Affairs. But on the Senate side, and the Senate did unanimously quickly confirm DSS director, finally after 8 months without a director, but then two other appointees got rejected basically back to back, which was a real kind of slap to McMaster. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that's a winner and a loser. Education was a winner and a loser because you've got a lot of things at least going forward. You've got some education pieces in the budget, but then obviously the big stuff didn't get through.
And then education also kind of finding their voice too. You mentioned with SC
right.
for Ed.
SC for Ed, mm-hmm. huge because, you know, they didn't even exist a year ago and yeah. boom, they had this 10,000 person march. But again, the verdict is still out as to whether some of the tactics or the messaging of that group will actually backfire. Mm-hmm. So major win for SC for Ed, but we'll see whether it is a winner or a loser next year.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. A lot happened. Like we said, a little bit more didn't happen, I guess we could say, than did. But there's still time left this month. We're going to be seeing conference committees, which are made up of three House and three Senate lawmakers, meeting on several bills that pass both chambers but need reconciliation. Lawmakers will return on May 20th to pass the budget and other bills, and we'll keep up with those. But thanks to Shauna Adcox with the Post and Courier and Avery Wilkes with the State Newspaper for recapping the first session of the 123rd South Carolina General Assembly. Thanks, guys, but I'm still going to have to give our discussion a cannon shot. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
It's time again for some campaign trail news updates. We're looking at the latest in 2020 related movements affecting South Carolina, state campaign news, and highlights from the state's congressional delegation. The latest Post and Courier Change Research poll surveyed 595 likely South Carolina Democratic primary voters and found that Joe Biden has 46% support, followed by Bernie Sanders with 15%, Kamala Harris with 10%, and Pete Buttigieg is tied with Elizabeth Warren at 8%. Everyone else is under 4%. The poll has a margin of error of plus or minus 4%, and Biden has the strongest support among black voters, who make up a majority of the Democratic electorate. Senator Tim Scott told McClatchy, D.C. that he was part of a meeting with a small group of Republican senators at the White House this month and said that he told the president directly that slapping tariffs of up to 25% on imported cars and parts from Europe could ultimately harm South Carolina's economy. Beijing said on Monday that it will raise tariffs on roughly $60 billion worth of U.S. goods on June 1st. This follows Friday's increase in U.S. tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese exports, from 10% to 25%, according to CNN. The Hill newspaper reports that Senate Republicans are growing increasingly frustrated with acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney. They see the former House lawmaker from South Carolina as an obstacle to striking deals on spending. They worry that the intra-party battle could spill over into high-profile debates on fiscal matters, such as raising the debt ceiling and avoiding another government shutdown. And just keeping with 2020, at 2 p.m. on Saturday, Senator Bernie Sanders will be at Denmark Technical College. You can find him there for Environmental Justice Town Hall. And if you want to go and get more information, visit BernieSanders.com. In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure that lawmakers use when speaking to each other. And did you know that South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney is back with some state trivia for us?
Back.
He's here, back from our time in Rock Thrill. Had a great showing there, and I think I got all those trivia questions correct.
I don't recall it exactly like that.
But I remember there were hand signs coming from the audience. Okay, Russ, what do you got for us this week?
Well, we've been talking about this year's session of the legislature, and, you know, one thing that kind of stands out to me is there wasn't any real contentious issue that lawmakers had to deal with this year. But obviously, over the years, there have been many. None more contentious than the debate and vote in 1786 to move the state capital from Charleston to the middle of the state. Reports show it was quite a Donnybrook and debate and vote with the decision finally made to create a new capital. Just as contentious as the vote to move the capital from Charleston, and that was a fight, and the fight that actually continued on for many years after the General Assembly made the decision, was what to name the new capital city.
A lot of resentment still there, I would say.
There is.
Of course, I don't know much north abroad myself.
That's right. But anyway, the vote following that was very contentious on what to name, and obviously Columbia was chosen. The term Columbia, as I'm sure you well know, is the personification of the United States, usually thought of as the female personification of the nation.
Columbia Recording. Right?
Correct. And Columbia River, Columbia Broadcasting System. How about Washington, the District of Columbia?
Or so it's called now that is the District. But
the District, you know, right.
Whatever.
So our question is, what was the runner-up name in the General Assembly to name our new capital, which ultimately became Columbia? Which name almost, and if I had to bet, I would say maybe the House favored one and the Senate another.
Zing.
Anyway, what was the number two name that was in consideration to be this name of the new state capital?
Okay.
A, Congaree. B, Middleborough. C, Lexington. D, Washington.
Washington. I mean, isn't that name enough? You know, they got enough of that. Middleborough. Have we talked about Middleborough before? Am I pronouncing it right? Middleborough?
I'm not sure.
He said Congaree, Middleborough,
Lexington, Washington. And remember, this is taking place, you know, 10 years after the, or less than 10 years after the Revolutionary War. Hint.
Yeah. Lexington, right there.
Was it there then?
No, I'm good. Yeah, but I mean, if it was there later, then maybe it's like, oh, we'll just shove you off. Sure, let's go with Lexington.
Okay, good
second,
guess.
Second to Columbia.
Good guess. The answer is Washington.
So again, like I say, how many places are you going to put your name?
Yeah, so we came close to being here today in Washington, South Carolina. But obviously, Columbia was. Now, during the debate.
Hence the District of Columbia hint prior.
During the debate, there was a lot of snarky names recommended, especially by the so-called Charleston elites.
Here we go.
No, we better not go there. But we ended up with Columbia.
Of course.
With Columbia.
Reminds me of a discussion we had at the club. All right, Russ, thanks again.
My pleasure.
The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on scetv.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV, Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's Super Easy Choose app and southcarolinapublicradio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. Search us easily on your Android, the NPR One app, or wherever you find podcasts. Also, be sure to rate and review us on iTunes, like friend of the pod, Towner McGill. Thank you, thank you, thank you! Follow us on Instagram at SCLeadPod, and you can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course, our dank memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle, at SCLEDEPOD. We have swag, sticker swag, that is. Send us a direct message on Twitter or Instagram with your address, and we'll send one your way. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scled@scetv.org. South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier and the state newspaper. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on May 13th, 2019. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening.
Secret message. If you didn't post on social media about Mother's Day, do you really love your mother? 'Cause Hallmark and Mark Zuckerberg say no.